Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'll be talking with Francine Blau, Professor of Labor Economics at Cornell University, and our topic will be Women in Work. Francine, glad to have you on the show.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
All right, our overall topic is women in work. It might be helpful to begin with a little bit of history, kind of get some kind of perspective on the number of women who've been involved in work. And I know you've got some statistics about the number of women who work at the turn of the century. Maybe that's a good place to begin.
Okay, I think one thing to bear in mind when we look at this topic is it's something that's changed a lot over time, and it is helpful to look back and realize that around the turn of the century, just one in five women in the population actually worked outside the home. And the pattern was overwhelmingly one where women may have worked when they were young and single, but they left the labor force permanently when they married.
Okay. Could you briefly explain why it was? Why did so few women work outside the home?
Well, I think it's helpful to look at this from two sides. On the one hand is what they had to or needed to do in the home. And you have to think back to what housework entailed in days when the family was very large. Homemakers didn't have modern conveniences. They couldn't buy many of the prepared foods. Even clothing may have had to be made at home by hand. So they were very busy in the home. At the same time, on the other side, they had relatively few opportunities in the labor market. So the combination of those two things, a lot to do at home and few opportunities in the market, combined with social attitudes that strongly believed that women's place was in the home, that was something that pretty much tied women to the household at that time.
Okay, so a combination of those two factors would seem to be the primary explanation. Clearly that has changed, at least in part. And it maybe be helpful to talk about the trends, the way in which the number of women working outside the home has changed.
The crucial factor was a change in the behavior of married women. And so really the increase in employment of women outside the home is a fundamental shift in gender roles. And that shift has had an important effect on men, women, and children in society as a whole. That change started during and after World War II, that is in the 1940s. So we begin, for example, in 1940, we had 28% of women over of working age working outside the home. Today, that figure has risen to 60%. And if we look at women in the so-called prime working ages, 25 to 44, in excess of 70% of them are in the labor force. So this has been an enormous shift, but at the same time, there have been some changes in male participation as well. Quite consistently over our history, about 80 to 85% of men were in the labor force. But their labor force participation has actually decreased in recent years. And now about 75% of them are employed. So we've got these trends, great increases, dramatic increases for women, more modest declines for men. But what this means taken as a whole is that the participation in market work of men and women is becoming much more equal.
So roughly, 60% to 75%.
Right.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you mentioned, though, a moment ago in talking about why more women didn't work outside the home at the turn of the century was the enormous responsibilities around the home. During this time, has that changed? Have women substantially decreased the amount of time they're doing work in the home while they're also working outside the home? Are men spending a lot more time working in the home?
Well, interestingly, what has happened is, yes, women have decreased the amount of time they spend in the home, and part of that is related to having smaller families, having the use of modern conveniences, being able to purchase many things in the market that people used to have to do for themselves within the home. So that has led to a decline in housework. And if you look at women, women's time spent in housework, you find that women who work outside the home do spend less time on housework than women who are not employed outside the home, that is, women who are full-time homemakers. But the interesting thing is that women still retain, in the average American family, women still retain the primary responsibility for housework. So in all this time, only, I would say, in the past 10 to 20 years has there been really any increase in the amount of time that men spend in housework. And that's been an increase of about an hour a week.
Okay, and how would a man's time around the house compare to a woman's time around the house?
Right. Women spend many multiples of the time that men spend.
Okay.
So I think that men's time around the house is equal to maybe about a quarter of the time that women spend.
Okay. I realize there's one other question I should have asked you a moment ago before we move on. You were talking about the comparative figures, men and women in the workforce. Are these full-time people who are employed full-time, or are some percentage of them part-time?
Well, that's an interesting question. Women are much more likely to work part-time than men are. And this has been actually an important development facilitating women's entry into the labor market. One of the reasons women did not work outside the home at the turn of the century is that virtually no part-time work was available, and full-time work was perhaps as long as 60 hours a week. But on the other hand, the proportion of women who are working full-time year-round is steadily increasing. So more and more work is starting to fill a kind of similar role in women's lives as the role it plays in men's lives.
Now let's move and talk about a couple of specific features. First of all, I want to talk about where it is that women work. And then after we talk about that a while, we want to talk about the income or the salaries, compensation for that work. On the first issue, are there any obvious trends about the differences between the kinds of jobs that men have and the kinds of jobs that women have?
When I first started looking into this topic, which was now almost 25 years ago, one of the most striking things of looking at the occupational distributions of men and women was the enormous extent to which there was occupational segregation by sex, which is the term we give for most jobs being either predominantly male or predominantly female, and women tending to be employed in the women's jobs, men being employed in men's jobs. The extent of occupational segregation is still substantial today, and we can sort of call this to mind. If I just mention an occupation to you, you probably picture either a man or a woman, and if we look at the data, we find that indeed most of the incumbents of that in that job are, you know, what you're picturing, men or women. So if I said nurse, you'd probably picture a woman. If I said even today lawyer, you might well picture a man, and they do remain the majority of people in that job. But the important point, or an extremely important point, is this occupational segregation has been declining. And specifically, if you think back to around the early 1970s, over half of women were in service or clerical jobs. In fact, some clever social scientists coined the term the pink-collar ghetto to describe those jobs. So over half of women were in this pink-collar ghetto, and that has shrunk to 41% today. So, again, occupational segregation is substantial, but women have made a great deal of progress moving into traditionally male managerial jobs and traditionally male professions like law, medicine, architecture, etc.
Do you have any figures of what percentage of people in the professions now are women?
Well, actually, a somewhat higher proportion of women than men are employed in the professions. I think it's about 16% of women and a somewhat smaller percentage of men. But that overall figure is quite misleading because, again, despite substantial progress and gains, many professions are either predominantly female or predominantly male. Women are the majority of elementary and secondary school teachers, as well as preschool teachers. Women are, again, as I mentioned before, the majority of nurses and dietitians. And men do, you know, are really the great majority of people employed as engineers and in jobs of that sort. So, that I mentioned before.
All right. Would it be fair to say then that even the term professions, as you're describing, is really a fairly broad term because it includes nurses, elementary school teachers, and so on. And if you thought about the professions, you could almost divide them into two groups, what might be called the higher professions, law, medicine, engineering, and perhaps even high-level managerial jobs. If you divide it in that way, would there still be fairly clear segregation that, for the most part, the higher professions are going to be made up, certainly the more highly compensated professions are going to be made up largely of men, and the less well-paid professions will be primarily women?
Absolutely. I think that's still true. And, you know, I do want to make the point there has been substantial progress, but that generalization still, I think, is accurate.
All right. Now we got to ask the next question, though, is why this segregation? Certainly, historically, one of the explanations has been that it was entirely voluntary, that jobs like nursing, school teaching, were jobs that appeal to women's natures. That was the sort of standard explanation. Women were more caring, and so they went into caring professions. Is that sort of explanation plausible at all, or are there better ones?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, this is the kind of thing social scientists debate about. But in my estimation, there are a variety of causes that contribute to this. And when you say the point you make about it being a caring profession, I would sort of classify that as in part reflecting the power of socialization. That is, girls are brought up to aspire to jobs, or certainly in the past were brought up to aspire to jobs that were considered appropriate in some sense for women. And that would tend to channel them into those occupations. Other factors, I think, that play a role would be many of these professions require extensive formal training through college and after college even. And traditionally, looking back, when women anticipated leaving the labor force for a substantial period of time after they married and had children, then they were reluctant to undertake those large investments. So those are all factors that economists classify on the supply side in terms of the voluntary choices that men and women make, in terms of the impact of the family through the socialization process. But I think it's very important to point out that discrimination also plays a role. That is, historically, there's considerable evidence it was quite important. And perhaps we can illustrate this with the experience of the women who are currently on the Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor. Both of them have reported that when they graduated from law school in the 1950s, near the top or at the top of their class, I mean, widely regarded as excellent students, they were unable to find jobs in law firms at that time. So outright discrimination historically certainly played a role. What's more important today, in my opinion, is perhaps more subtle types of discrimination, where people don't view themselves consciously as discriminating against women, but they may harbor views about how good a job women would do. Now, one fascinating study that I've read that I just find really striking is that when college students, and this is actually both male and female college students, were given the exact same essay, but in one case, for one group, they were told that it was written by a woman, say Jane Doe, and in another case, for another group, they were told that it was written by a man, say John Doe. And both the men and the women actually gave higher evaluations to the essay when they thought it was written by a man. Other factors that have been spoken about that I think are important in terms of subtle barriers would be the absence of role models. So women entering these predominantly male areas have to be really pioneers and blaze their own way. And they also may tend to be discouraged by the fact that it may be harder for them to find a mentor to guide them along because most of the incumbents in the job are male and they're more interested and identify more with younger people who are also male. And the old boys network that a lot of people talk about where people trade information and job opportunities over a beer on Friday night or in a bowling league. And just traditionally, in the women may be excluded from the so-called old boys network.
Let me ask you too. You began by talking about certain economic considerations, which may partly explain the differences in occupational choice. But it sounds like when you went on to describe the power of socialization, perhaps especially, but also the subtle discrimination, that those may not only be direct influences which have pushed women into certain kinds of careers, but have indirectly influenced the economic considerations or factors that you mentioned.
Well, I think that's a very good point, because if I was contemplating going to law school in the 1950s, but I thought no firms would hire lawyers, then I might women as lawyers, then I might be pretty foolish to undertake that investment. So barriers and obstacles in the labor market feed back into the decisions that people make. That's right.
All right, let's shift and talk about not so much about the nature of the jobs that people choose, but the incomes that they receive for the jobs they do choose. Perhaps before we talk about what the explanation is, maybe we just ought to have some information about the relative salaries of men compared to women, both in the past and now currently.
Yes. Well, that's definitely a very good question, and it is useful to have a baseline. An interesting point is that for many years, throughout the 1950s, 60s, and most of the 1970s, women, on average, working full-time and year-round, on average earned about 60% of what men earned. You know, sometimes it was a little higher, sometimes it was a little lower, but there was virtually no action and no change. One very positive development was that starting in the late 1970s and most dramatically during the 1980s, there was a great deal of progress. And so currently, women earn about, by this measure, the annual earnings of full-time year-round workers, women earn about 72% of what men earn. And by another measure that's frequently used, the usual weekly earnings of full-time workers, they actually earn 77% of what men earn. But one thing I would call attention to here is that much of this progress, not all of it, but much of it did occur in the 1980s, and there's been not too much sign of further convergence since then.
All right, the other thing I might wonder is this going to be true of women of all ages, or will younger women, for example, be more likely to have higher salaries relative to men?
Yes, that's a very interesting point. What tends to happen is at relatively young ages, women do better relative to men, And the pay gap tends to increase with age. So one way I sometimes put it is the pay different, the earnings difference tends to fan out as workers age.
All right. What are some of the standard explanations for this gap in income?
Well, the standard explanations can be divided into two broad sets of factors, and then within each of them we'll want to focus on a few. But on the one hand, it does focus on the decisions that men and women themselves make. It's very much like the discussion we were just having about occupations. On the one hand, because of especially historically, women's expectations that they would spend less time in the labor market than men, then they would get less job-oriented training before they even entered the labor market. The very fact that they were in a shorter period of time meant that they had less experience, and economists have found that in general, earnings increase with experience. The fact that they were channeled or chose to go into these traditionally female jobs that often pay less than male jobs. So these types of explanations that focus on the qualifications of women compared to men, the decisions that women make compared to men, they certainly are part of the story. But when you do statistical analyses that endeavor as best as we possibly can to control for these differences in qualifications, you find that even after controlling for them, women earn less than what men earn. And that suggests that labor market discrimination plays a role in explaining the pay differences. That is, when women present themselves to the labor market every bit as qualified as men, as best as we can determine through statistical analyses, even today, they do earn less than what a man earns.
How much less?
Well, depending on what you adjust for. For example, in one study I did with a colleague here at Cornell, Lawrence Kahn, we found that if you adjust for any differences in the education of men and women workers and differences in the amount of experience they've accumulated, instead of a ratio of, say, 72%, you can get the ratio of what women earn compared to men, you can get that up to, say, 80%. So controlling for these types of qualifications, and of them, I must say, the most important is the gender difference in experience, because women's educational attainment is actually quite similar to men's, although there are some disparities at the very upper end with professional school and graduate school that are related to the difference in the professions that we talked about earlier. Now, if in addition to, if you add controls not just for experience and education, but if in addition you add controls for the occupations that people are in and the industries that people are in and whether or not they're union workers, the ratio rises to 88%. So when all the factors that we can measure are taken into account, there's a 12% gap between what a woman would earn and what a man would earn. Now, about that second figure, I'd like to make the point that when we control for occupation and industry, we get back to that question as to why women are in different occupations and why they tend to be concentrated in different industries. To some extent, it may indeed represent their own choices. Then it makes sense to control for that factor. But it could also reflect the discriminatory action of employers. And in that respect, then, if that's the case, or to the extent that's the case, we wouldn't want to control for these factors. So what I would say is that even controlling for objective qualifications, the data suggests that women the ratio of women's to men's pay is about 80 to 88% of what men earn.
Okay. We've only got about 3.5 minutes left. I want to ask one question of clarification and then maybe talk about where we ought to go. As I understand it then, if we assume that choices of jobs is wholly voluntary and non-discriminatory, which earlier you suggested was false, even if we assume that, again, it's wholly voluntary, it's still the case that a man and a woman in exactly the same job with exactly the same training, the same background, the woman will earn 88 cents to every man for the dollar.
That is correct.
And if you assume that the choice of professions is discriminatory, then the figure even today is still probably closer to 80%.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Given that, there's still, 80 cents in the dollar is a pretty dramatic change. In the last 2 minutes, what would you suggest that we try to do to make the choice of jobs and the compensation for jobs more equal?
Well, let me first say that we have on the books laws prohibiting discrimination, and I think we actually have a good set of laws. We do have to make sure that they are enforced and continue to be enforced. But I think a lot of the action in the future, because those laws are on the books, is in the area of facilitating women, but hopefully in the long run, both men and women, balancing their family responsibilities and their work responsibilities. So what we have to look at is facilitating workers being able to take care of their responsibilities on both fronts. And when I say men as well as women, I think another part of the agenda that I see as important, but not something that you can easily legislate, is that men need to continue the trend towards taking on a larger responsibility for the work that's done in the household.
How do you do this? I mean, do you use, thinking of the term used in the last presidential race, do you use the bully pulpit? How do you try to change people's fairly basic behavior, for example, in terms of their responsibilities around the home?
Well, I guess when I was growing up, that was the $64,000 question. Now I suppose it's the $1 million question. I think part of it, though, is the types of policies that facilitate meshing family and work responsibilities. We have to be sure that they are made available to both male and female employees. So if we make child care available, when we make parental leave available, we have to be sure that both the male and the female employees are encouraged to take advantage of this. And I've seen through personal experience that if the child care center is at the man's place of work, then he will start to be the one taking the child back and forth to the child care center. I think the bully pulpit, too, is extremely important. And I think we have to over and over make the point that if we do want to see true equality for women in the labor market, and not just the labor market, but the larger society, in politics, in higher institutions of higher education, et cetera, then we really do need to get a greater equalization of the work that's done around the household.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Francine Blau, Professor of Labor Economics at Cornell University. This is Hugh Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.